The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Time now for the second hour of the Jimmy Sangenberger Show here on News Talk 710 KNUS. And you know, folks, as we listen to Skynyrd sing about what they know a little about, I got to say, I know a little about politics in 2020. And one little fact is that Republicans have to make gains here in the state of Colorado. And more specifically, folks, Jason Crow has got to go, and I am pleased to be joined by the man working diligently to replace him as the Republican nominee for the 6th Congressional District. Steve House rejoins us here on the Jimmy Sangenberger Show. Steve, welcome back. Good to talk with you, sir.
It's always good to be with you, Jimmy. How are you?
You know, I'm doing pretty well, all things considered, with all the insanity going on, it seems, across the country. What do you make of it all? How are things going with you, too?
You know, I think that it is sort of insanity. I think we've lost our mind in a couple of areas. And I think the threat of what's going to happen on November 4th or, you know, leading up to the election, you know, I just think it's crazy that America's in a situation where people are anticipating that there's going to be destruction and riots and things like that when we don't know the outcome yet. And it's just horrible what's happening. People don't feel safe in their homes right now.
No, safety is a top concern, to be sure. We're going to talk about that this evening with you. But one of the things in my mind that's just so striking is to the point that you're raising is all of the suspicion around what might happen on November 4th or what we might not know as well in the case of the presidential race, for example, with all these states that will still be counting ballots potentially 2 weeks after the election, which is pretty staggering when you think about it. And then all the lawsuits we may see, it could be something.
It could be. I hope it doesn't go beyond.
Me too.
The third. I mean, there's a lot of assumption that it's going to be close, but that's based on poll data. We know how iffy poll data can be. So hopefully it's just a clear victory for the president and we move forward.
All right, Steve House, let's start from the top. Remind us, who are you and why are you running for Congress?
I'm a longtime healthcare guy, executive, biomedical engineer, farmer originally. I'm running for CD6. I'm the former state GOP chair as well. I'm a guy who believes in action. We got a lot of great plans for how we're going to deal with healthcare, education, immigration reform, even some of the stuff on racial justice that needs to be dealt with. I think we're prepared to do that, and I want to, you know, win this seat and represent CD6 very well in Congress.
I think right now we especially need people who are focused on the policy side of things with all the issues that are plaguing this country. And one of the top issues, you were talking about this just a moment ago, Steve, that is on top of mind for countless Coloradans and folks in the 6th Congressional District, which includes Aurora, is safe communities. I mean, there are a lot of people who are just wondering, am I safe in my own community? And is there anything that the federal government can do to help ensure safer communities? What say you to that important issue?
Well, I mean, government's number one priority for us keep us safe. And that's not just federal government, that's federal, state, and local government. You know, when you have people going to restaurants with trumpets and blowing in people's ears and saying that's a peaceful protest while someone's trying to eat dinner and, you know, being disruptive, that's one thing. Obviously, property damage, looting, those things, there's a whole other scale of it. But it's gotten to be a really serious problem. And if we don't get government to do its job and keep us safe, then what do we have government for?
So what can the federal government actually do? Because you're running for Congress, not the state legislature. What would you like to see done by Congress or by the president?
Well, I think there comes a point, and clearly Donald Trump is smart enough, his advisors are smart enough to know that states' rights allow governors to call in the National Guard when the time comes. I think there does come a point where the president has the right to act if things don't get done. He hasn't used that power yet, but I think that, you know, as a congressman, I would say, look, if people are dying, if they're losing their property, if they've lost their freedom and the state's not willing to deal something about it, at some point the federal government has to step in.
And so it's a matter of figuring out what that role would be in particular, because there's only certain areas where the federal government automatically has jurisdiction.
That is correct. And so, therefore, you know, I think the president's advisors are probably having conversations about this on a daily basis just to figure out, okay, what can we do if Portland, Oregon doesn't settle down? You know, what can we do if Louisville turns into a horrible situation where other people start dying? I mean, if those kinds of things happen and government's number one priority is to keep us safe, at some point in time, all levels of government have to step in and do something.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And then something else that ties in with safety and security is this issue of COVID-19 and healthcare. You described yourself as a healthcare guy earlier this year when you just were gearing up to announce your own healthcare plan. You came on the show in studio. We had a phenomenal conversation about your healthcare plan at the time. And now people are really attuned to this issue of healthcare because it does tie in with safety and all these issues related to COVID-19.
It certainly does. I mean, one of the things we've learned about COVID, beyond all the things we've learned, is that, you know, right now the people in our country who are aging are not aging well. Not due, you know, mostly to their own situation or their own fault. I mean, I think it's really just an issue of, you know, you got to understand how to build your immunity, what you need to be doing from a food perspective, you know, how to extend your life if that's what you want. But, you know, our elderly people, if you will, 75 and older, took a huge hit from COVID, and we need to take a look at what we can do to make it better in the future.
And so from your experience in healthcare and also from what we've learned about COVID-19 and how it's all unfolded, what are the key things that jump out to you right now as maybe need to be done differently?
I think people need to have incentive to be healthy, first and foremost. Mm. You know, there are countries that run the best health systems in the world actually give their people incentive to be healthy. They give them incentive to have to lower their blood pressure, to lower their BMI, to deal with, you know, blood sugar problems and things like that, to, you know, to have healthy lifestyles and exercise. All of those things are relevant. Not everybody wants to do that stuff, but if you give people enough incentive in the right way, then I think you can get them, you know, to where they need to be from a health perspective. And quite frankly, you know, things as simple as vitamin D, right? I mean, I think, you know, vitamin D is hard to come by in Colorado, and if the darker your skin is, the harder it is. Those are a lot of things that we need to do.
Again, Steve House, our guest, Republican candidate for the 6th Congressional District up against Jason Crow. Yeah, when you look at COVID-19, I mean, one of the things that has exacerbated this virus in many parts of this country has been obesity. I mean, there are countries around the globe that don't have the level of obesity that we do. And what that has done for their own societies is help prevent perhaps some of the larger numbers of deaths or a higher rate of death in their country. In the United States, if you have obesity, you might be more susceptible to this virus. And that is arguably one of the reasons why our death count and death rate has exceeded some other countries that don't have obesity as much, which goes to the core of what you're talking about in terms of preventative medicine.
Yeah. I mean, there's no question that obesity is a factor in, you know, your longevity in any number of ways. I mean, we have, you know, on average in a flu season, we have 95,000 people a day getting the flu. I think we have to look at how all those viruses affect people with obesity. And we got to figure out ways to help them get moved forward and live a healthier lifestyle. I mean, it's up to them, right? I mean, it's still freedom, still their individual choice. But here's a stat that always drives me crazy, Jimmy. You know, one person out of every 16 million people who get on an airplane are killed in an airplane crash. Yeah, when you get on an airplane, you're scared to death, right? I mean, some people are afraid at multiple levels. I fly a lot. I'm not as afraid. But one person dies, more than one person dies every minute in America from cardiovascular disease. Why are we not afraid of dying from cardiovascular disease, which is a direct result of lifestyle choices you make, sometimes genetic, but more lifestyle than anything else? Why are we not so afraid of it? We're doing something about it.
Then getting to the core of the healthcare issue, and I know that you have a very detailed plan with a lot of different components to it. What are the things that you need to be, that you think we need to be doing differently, Steve House, especially from the incentive standpoint that you're talking about?
Well, first and foremost, we have to have transparency. Without transparency, you know, you're talking about a market that is the only market in the world, or in our world, where we don't know the price before we pay, you know, get billed for it or consume the service. Without transparency, people won't change because you can't give them an appropriate incentive. So we need that first and foremost. I think what happens then is that you put money in a medical savings account for people of all backgrounds, all socioeconomic statuses, instead of buying them high cost insurance, and you make them pay for some of their healthcare out of that medical savings account. So imagine Jimmy Sangenberger owns an account every year. You know, maybe it's, you know, $5,000 goes into the account. When you need a primary care doc, you use up some of it. But you start making decisions based on wanting that account to grow. When you're 60 years old, 65 years old, Jimmy, if your health status is good enough, you'll be able to move a fair amount of that over into a retirement account. And that'll be part of your incentive, is that you'll get to keep this money rather than paying it to insurance in huge quantities and at the end of the year having nothing to show for it.
Yeah, one of the big reasons why healthcare costs are so high is because we do have this third-party payer system. We've talked about this before with you, Steve House, where you're separated from the cost because it's not, and it's not transparent. So you're not paying attention to what is actually the expense that you're putting forward for healthcare, and we need to get that back into shape, shall we say?
Well, yeah, if you think about it. Obamacare, you know, if you really look at Obamacare, Obamacare probably had good intentions, but you can't put a new system over top of a highly dysfunctional market. And what I mean by highly dysfunctional market is there's no supply and demand responses. People don't know what the pricing is. It takes, for example, gasoline, right? You go to the gas station, you get gas in your car. Do you even know what you're paying? Do you know what the exact amount per gallon is you're paying, Jimmy?
No, especially when you're also talking about gas taxes, for example.
Right. So you don't know what you're paying. And the reason why you don't know what you're paying is the market has almost perfect information. Competition says is good enough that virtually every gas station charges you the same amount of money for an 85 octane gas. Healthcare could do the same thing. People worry about doing transparency in healthcare, and then you got to go shopping for healthcare, and you're going to go, wow, I don't know the difference between a one Tesla MRI and a three Tesla MRI. Well, it won't take very long before the market will stabilize around the best value. And then much like gas, you'll say, if I need an MRI, there may be some nuanced differences in when you can get it or the quality, but you'll be able to navigate that easily. Until you fix the market, until you make it respond to supply and demand, until you make it into a true market where patients are paying and making decisions on what they're paying for, it's not going to work, no matter what you do.
Yeah, that's for sure. I want to go back to the COVID-19 issue from a different standpoint. Joe Biden, who, of course, is running to defeat President Trump, we have to make sure that that does not happen and that we reelect President Donald Trump, of course. But he's willing to lock down the American economy again, to have a national mask mandate, to take those kinds of steps at the federal level. What do you make of that, this idea of Biden to assume more power in the presidency in terms of locking down the American economy, the mask mandates, so on and so forth?
Well, first of all, it's not constitutional. I don't think there's any way you can justify it as being constitutional. Secondly, you know, we've made a lot of progress on the coronavirus. I mean, the vaccines are in final stage trials. You know, we're looking at an average daily death rate, you know, that falls around 700. They were predicting it to be 2,000, 3,000 a day. You know, infections are down into the mid-30s and falling. And infections are the wrong thing to measure to begin with because, you know, people are going to get infected. You know, Boulder at CU, you know, they just had a shutdown where, you know, if you're 18 to 24 years old, you can't be seen with another 18 to 24-year-old, even one person. You have to be socially distanced from everybody. Well, you know what? We're going to have some infections. That's the way it goes. Once you get enough infections, then you end up getting a scenario where you move beyond them and you get some herd immunity. So I don't think a nationwide mask mandate, first of all, is not constitutional. Secondly, what do you do for those people who live in Yuma and Ray and all those other places? It's just insane what he's proposing.
Well, and the idea of locking down the American economy or shutting it down again, quote, if the science requires, and of course, science is always subjective when you're talking about public policy and how you want to approach the science. That is just ludicrous, especially when we have so many businesses that are already struggling to get back on their feet and Americans who are trying to find work.
Well, yeah, I think what you're seeing is you're seeing a guy who wants to win an election. He's looking at polls on a daily basis. Whatever the poll says, he just simply says, all right, I'm going to be for that. And, you know, people are smarter than that. You know, if you get into any reasonable discussion with people and you say, look, we're going to lock the whole country down. Your kids are going to have to stay at home again for another 2 months. It's not going to kill the virus. The virus is going to have to still infect people until we get beyond a certain point plus a vaccine. Joe Biden doesn't know what he's talking about.
Now, in terms of the economy, I mean, obviously Congress didn't pass another so-called stimulus package. What do you think is necessary? And what would you advocate for in Congress come January, Steve House, representing the 6th Congressional District? What do you think needs to be done to help get the economic gears rolling again, even more than they already are, to the surprise of some folks, especially in the media, who are not expecting the private sector to really be bouncing back as much as it is? I mean, we've still got a ways to go, but a lot of people are surprised that we're doing as well as we are.
Well, and part of it is that we've got to, first of all, we've got to deal with liability for businesses. So, you know, I had an opportunity today to be on the phone with Burger King franchise owners, and they're all saying, look, we can't open our doors to the lobby for two reasons. One is you got to deal with liability. I mean, if people think they got COVID at a Burger King and they get sued, I mean, people go out of business for those things. The second thing is you can't get people to come back to work because the unemployment stimulus numbers were too high. So we got to deal with both of those things. I think we have to also look at a target of, you know, what businesses in mass went out of business. I think restaurants in general need a different sort of a PPP approach than we've had. I think we need to look at what they need and how we're going to do that. And I think that if you look at it, one of the biggest, hardest hit groups in the entire country was 41% of the total, or 440,000 black owned small businesses died during COVID. Most of them for a lack of capital. Not a lack of expertise. You need capital and expertise to run a business, as you know. So I think we got to go back and look at those and go, can we run a restart program? There are concepts out there about restarting certain businesses. I think we need to look at that right away. Other than that, I think I'd wait to see what happens from there.
A few minutes left with our guest, Steve House, Republican nominee for the 6th Congressional District. Because, folks, Jason Crow has got to go. I want to ask you about the politics of the Supreme Court of the United States and this vacancy open left by the late Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Of course, the House of Representatives has no role in selecting, or rather approving, a nominee, confirming that person to the courts. But nevertheless, we do see the current Speaker of the House, who we'd also like to see go. She's talking about how the House could possibly intervene and at least gum up the works of this nomination confirmation process. What do you make of the House's potential role in trying to stop this nomination?
I think you can add to your list that Jason Crow, I think, called and left Cory Gardner a message that Cory should call him so he could give him some advice about the Supreme Court. I don't think Cory's going to return that phone call. I'm fairly sure of that. You know, the House doesn't really have a role in this. I mean, not constitutionally. The only thing the House could do is intervene in a place that isn't really designed to do, which is, you know, theories where Nancy was going to consider another impeachment to tie up the Senate with impeachment documentation, which they would have to react to so that they could not, you know, elect or confirm a Supreme Court nominee. I don't think even she will do that.
No, I don't either. She would set quite a precedent in taking that sort of step. Oh, let's just impeach in order to gum up the works in the other legislative chamber. I mean, really, that's what you're looking to do? So let's get you. We mentioned Jason Crow a few times. What is the biggest reason, Steve House, that Jason Crow has got to go? And then number two, what is the biggest reason that Steve House should replace him in the House of Representatives?
I think the biggest reason he's got to go is that he hasn't accomplished much of anything. I mean, he's been a congressman, and some people say he's a nice guy. Some say he's not. I think the real issue is if you look at economic opportunity, the cost of health care, and the performance we're getting out of education, now you got to add, you know, racial injustice to this. I think in that particular case, you're dealing with a scenario where he just hasn't accomplished anything. If you're 2 years into a job almost and you haven't done anything about your primary objective, then you're just not gonna, you know, not gonna get anywhere with me. I think the reason why you put me in there is because I've got more experience in business and life. I'm a healthcare expert. Healthcare is one of the top issues. I have a passion for education and immigration. I think we'll get more done in my first year than he did in 2 years, because he frankly didn't do much of anything.
Yeah, the only thing I could think of when I consider what has Jason Crow left his mark on, and that was, and this is pure politics, of course, that he was one of the prosecutors in the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump.
That's correct. And he failed.
Yes, he failed. And I would argue he failed wonderfully, wonderfully so. I mean, it was just a complete flop, to be sure. Yep. Steve House, let me ask you a fundamental question. And I think I've asked you this before, but if, and I hope you are, you're elected to Congress, how will you view legislation from a philosophical standpoint? That is, when you're looking at it, what are the criteria that a bill has to meet for Steve House to say, you know what, I'm going to vote yes on that?
Well, it has to be constitutionally correct, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I wouldn't vote for anything that didn't meet the Constitution. I think it has to meet my criteria for, you know, fiscally responsible, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think we should be spending money. We shouldn't be sending money to the NIH to study, you know, prostitution in China, for example. I think it's got to be something that's fiscally responsible, that it supports the Americans' objectives. And of course, it has to be good for CD6. I mean, I think if it meets those criteria, it's certainly something we should take a hard look at.
Yeah, I think that's a good breakdown. And now I'm also wondering, from a campaign standpoint, how are you feeling? I know tomorrow being Sunday, I'm going to be playing harmonica at a meet and greet that you've got going on. So you've got things that are happening even despite this virus, and you've been calibrating on certain events that are in person, trying to get outdoors, doing Zoom things when you have to. Tell us about that side of things right now.
You know, I think people are a lot more comfortable getting outside and doing things together. I think we see more mask wearing on the inside, but in reality, I think people know what the risk is. We are getting out. We are doing events. We are dropping literature. We are meeting with businesses. We are doing all of those things, and I'm having a great time doing it. I think it's a lot of fun, and I think people need our help, and they're reacting really, really well to what we're doing with them.
Yeah, when you can bring in a little bit of music like Jimmy Sangenberger playing harmonica to an event, that's not a bad thing either.
Yep, that's right. That is going to get people to have something more to do than to listen to me talk, and I like that.
Yeah, who wants to listen to Steve House talk except when he's being interviewed by Jimmy Sangenberger? I mean, that's the only time that we want to hear Steve House talk, actually.
That's right, especially knowing you can edit it as you go if you like.
Yes, exactly. So, Steve, final question for you. Where can people go to learn more about you and your campaign, and a final word for our audience tonight?
You can go to houseforcolorado.com, houseforcolorado.com. You can find us there. I think the final word I would, you know, give to the audience is, we can win, but winning requires that we communicate to other people who we want to vote for. Word of mouth has a lot more to do with anything right now than does TV, radio, or anything else. So if you want to get active, when you get angry at the TV, sit down and email somebody and say, you know, vote Trump, Gardner, House, and send it out to 20 of your friends, because that's the best way for us to get this done.
Word of mouth is absolutely the key. Steve House, got to vote for him because Jason Crow has got to go. I'm looking forward to doing that, as I am a resident of the 6th Congressional District. Thanks so much for joining us, and best of luck to you, sir.
I'll see you tomorrow, man. Get your lips ready to play that harmonica.
I look forward to it. Once again, Steve House joining us here on the Jimmy Sangenberger Show. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be joined by John Kellner, Republican candidate for the 18th Judicial District Attorney. Stay tuned.
Turns back by the old stumble road. I'm gonna take you to a special place that nobody knows. Baby, get ready. Ooh, ooh. You and me go fishing in the dark, lying on our backs and counting the stars where the cool grass grows. Down by the river in the full moonlight, we'll be falling in love in the middle of the night, just moving slow. Stand the whole night through.
Welcome back to the Jimmy Sangenberger Show, News Talk 710 KNUS. You know, this blues man recently joined a country band called the Becker Band, and we've done a couple of gigs this weekend, and I have to say that one of the fun things about playing harmonica as a lead harmonica player in a country band, which is pretty darn fun to play, I have to tell you, country music, is that I'm able to add in more harmonica, because that tune right there from the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band just doesn't have enough harp. You need some more, and that's what I bring. I am so pleased now to welcome back to the Jimmy Sangenberger Show a country music fan himself, John Kellner, Republican nominee for the 18th Judicial District, returns here on 710 KNUS. John, my friend, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Jimmy. I appreciate you having me on. And way to expand your range and go into some country music. Good for you, man.
You know, I appreciate it. Although I will say that country is really like a close cousin, a first cousin to the blues. There's a lot of synergy. And in my case, all I really need to do, being completely honest, is I just hear the beginning of a song. I know what the key of the song is. And then I can just join in with the band. It's not too complicated, actually.
Well, good for you. I mean, I could never, ever, ever do that sort of thing. But awesome you to bring in some Nitty Gritty Dirt Band.
Yeah, glad you're enjoying it. And I have to say, did you ever play any instruments in your younger days? Ever try your hand at music?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was like every kid, you know, you played the drums or the flute or something at some point in your life. But no, it never took.
Yeah, I did guitar lessons for a number of years and started a couple years into guitar, maybe 3 or 4 years into guitar, I started picking up the harmonica, and I found much more of a knack for the harp. That's part of the reason why I gave up the guitar, I guess.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things that I kind of regret about my, you know, childhood. Really wish I'd picked something up. So
yeah.
Encouraging our kids, you know, our kids are 7 and 8 years old to get into an instrument. It's something you could just do your entire life and really fulfilling.
So, John, you're running for the 18th Judicial District. We had you on your first or second radio interview briefly last fall. We had you on several months back as well. I'm so glad to have you back as we are gearing up just a little over a week away from ballots dropping before we know it. What's going on here with your campaign and, well, who are you and why are you running?
It's so incredible that we're really right on the cusp now of, you know, ballots finally coming out and people are going to get, make their choices. And we've just been working so hard to get the word out about me and my campaign, what I want to do for this community. So, you know, a little bit about me. I joined the Marine Corps after 9/11. I was commissioned as a second lieutenant. They ended up sending me to law school, actually at CU in Boulder. Met my future wife there on our first day. I ended up serving 5 years on active duty. I was a judge advocate. I was a prosecutor most of the time, a federal prosecutor. Kind of tried every sort of case you can imagine in the military. I was a special assistant U.S. attorney in San Diego, too, deployed overseas to Afghanistan. And when I got back, you know, we were thinking about, okay, we're going to transition. I'm going to transition to the reserves. And my wife is from Colorado and really wanted to put down roots somewhere, you know, raise our kids in one place. Because I had grown up in a military family. You know, we moved every 2 or 3 years. And it was really important to me that I wanted to put down roots and continue to serve my community. So I became a prosecutor, been a state prosecutor for about the last, you know, almost 10 years, and joined the DA's office under our current DA, George Brockwer, on day one of his administration, started a cold case unit. It's been very successful bringing justice to people who had thought it was lost. A chief deputy DA used to run one of our largest felony prosecution teams in Arapahoe, in addition to that cold case unit. And now I'm actually the chief deputy DA in charge of the Douglas, Elbert, and Lincoln County offices. So those are the four counties that make up the judicial district. I'm really proud to have George Brockler's support to be the next DA, and I'm looking forward to doing things to really improve community safety and keep things going in a way that's good for our kids and public safety.
Talk to us for a moment a little more about the cold case unit, because I know we've spoken about this before, but it truly is impressive and remarkable. First, that District Attorney George Brockler allowed this unit to be started, tapped you to do that. But the kind of work that you're doing is truly powerful. I have seen some of the stories, some of the interviews and so forth with people who've been victims of these longstanding crimes that your unit has managed to successfully prosecute.
Yeah, it's a really incredible feeling to talk to victims, family members who had thought, you know, for decades sometimes that these cases just couldn't be solved. They've been told by law enforcement at one point or another, or by a prosecutor, that you just didn't have the evidence. And to reopen these cases, to work with law enforcement, to bring these things to fruition and get justice in court, it's an incredible feeling. I'll give you an example. So just recently, a couple months ago, we ended up doing the sentencing for a guy who committed a murder 40 years ago, you know, 1980. He had kidnapped a woman named Helene Brzezinski out of Englewood, sexually assaulted this young lady, stabbed her to death, and left her in Highlands Ranch, or what is Highlands Ranch now, and was just never able to figure out how to close the loop here. But working with law enforcement, the sheriff's office in Douglas County, using new technology, and this is just something that keeps on getting better and better. First it was touch DNA, now it's genetic genealogy. Ended up finding this guy in Florida under a different name, charged him, got him extradited here, convicted of first degree murder, sent to life in prison. It was just this really amazing sentencing hearing to have so many people from across the country who knew this young lady, the victim in the case, get on this hearing and talk about the impact that she had on their lives. And then, of course, the impact of losing her, and to see justice served after so long, just an incredible feeling.
John Kellner, when I hear you talk about the cold case unit, you're discussing some of those accomplishments, but also something that really it's real. Like, this is something that is these cases have impacted people for so many years. They never think that there's going to be resolution, and then you get it. And when that happens, that must truly be a relief to the families, but also to you and everybody else who's working on these teams, from the district attorney's office on to the police who handled these cases. And I'm wondering, from the campaign standpoint, because obviously you're running now to run the whole 18th judicial district, but what is it that you think this experience that you've had with the cold case unit and in other areas and some of the accomplishments shows about your capabilities to run this office?
The first thing I'd say is that it demonstrates my experience at being able to be the lead prosecutor for cases that matter to our community. And with all cases that matter, but there are some that really stand out, something like the theater shooting where George Brockler personally prosecuted that, because he's the most accountable person in that room to the community for the outcome, any of these serious cases. And I'll give you another example. So one case where we had just come in, it was Dave Walter at the time was the sheriff. He sat down with our team and said, look, this is a case that is really impactful. There was a refugee from Sudan. A guy was working multiple jobs, had a wife. He and his wife had fled religious persecution and moved to, you know, near Aurora, unincorporated Arapahoe County, to raise their kids. You know, they had five children, and to have a safe place to do that and you know, live the American dream. And this man had been killed in gang violence, basically a case of mistaken identity. Some gang members went to retaliate against a different gang member and they ended up killing the wrong guy. And the case had been cold. It was cold for a couple of years. We reopened it. We ended up working with law enforcement, finding some new evidence, some new witnesses, and ultimately convicted, I did, at trial, three different gang members of first-degree murder. And hearing the widow of the victim in this case get up at sentencing and say, this has restored my faith in the rule of law, because in her country where she came from, nobody would have cared. Nobody would have taken up the mantle seeking justice for her husband. But in America, we do. And when I was deployed to Afghanistan, I saw a place, there's no rule of law. There was no justice system. People didn't have access to justice. What we have here is, it's unique, really, in the world. It's the best justice system. It has flaws. And we're always working to improve them. But that's why I'm running. I'm running because I want people to understand that this justice system will work for them, that there are dedicated professionals who are competent and experienced and can achieve justice for them.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's incredibly personal to me.
Well, and one thing that just comes to my mind, because so many people across all four counties, I mean, across the state, but including the four counties that the 18th Judicial District includes, Arapaho, Douglas, Elbert, and Lincoln counties, John Kellner, so many people are concerned about issues of public safety, especially as we've seen riots and violence and mayhem engulf the Denver metro area at times, including Aurora, which is in Arapaho County, therefore in the 18th Judicial District. What do you think needs to be done moving forward from a law enforcement perspective to help enforce and ensure public safety? Because people need to feel safe in their own homes and in their communities. And quite frankly, John, I talk with a lot of folks who don't feel safe in a place like Aurora, Colorado, which was once recognized as one of the safest cities in the country. And I think at time, the safest city in Colorado, big city.
Yeah, I think that's such an important issue because right now, you know, people are feeling less secure. And, you know, we've seen once COVID hit, you know, the sort of shift, increased property crimes, a lot more auto thefts. I know you know about that.
Oh, yes, I do. Times two.
You do it. Yeah, exactly. And a lot of this happened because there was less enforcement going on because there was less of a throughput for people to arrest somebody and, you know, put them into the justice system, because the justice system has slowed down, if not shut down, for at least a couple months at the height of the pandemic. And the jails weren't accepting, you know, people on lower charges, things like auto theft. And what's happened is we've seen this explosion of violent crime in places like Aurora and in Denver. And to be clear for the listeners, you know, Aurora transcends actually three.
That's true.
Counties.
It
so
does.
The majority of it in Arapaho. Some of it's in Douglas. North of Colfax, you're in the 17th Judicial District. You're
right.
In Athens County. We don't have jurisdiction.
Thank you for clarifying that. I always forget, being an Aurora resident who's in Arapaho County, that, yes, it includes three counties. But two of the counties are in this 18th Judicial District.
Yeah. And I think there's this whole spectrum of outcomes in the justice system that need to all be employed to get a handle on some of the rising crime issues. And we were talking about things like shootings, attempted murders, aggravated robberies, people robbing somebody with a gun. I mean, look, there is no question that serious crime like that needs to be dealt with seriously and have serious consequences to deter future conduct like that from other people in the community and from that particular offender. That's something I have experience doing, something my opponent has literally no experience doing at the state level. But along this whole spectrum, you know, we have issues to deal with, something like the opioid epidemic that, you know, was a hot topic last year and the year before. There's a lot of talk about it. It's really gone under the radar with the pandemic, but it's still there, and it's exacerbated by the issues associated with the pandemic where people aren't able to get with their groups for, you know, AA or Narcotics Anonymous. They're not able to get as much treatment as they had been in the past. There's less of a connection with the people that kind of help with somebody's sobriety. And what we've seen is, you know, crime associated with things like drug addiction that gets people in the justice system and then keep on cycling through. I helped start a court called the Veterans Treatment Court that reduced recidivism dramatically in our judicial district. Worked with the judges, worked with the defense bar, treatment providers, both mental and drug treatment providers, probation departments, and then the community resources, mentors, who all got together and said, look, we want to help veterans that end up in the justice system and ensure that they get out of it, that they get back on their feet and are not committing new crimes. This process is called a problem-solving court, and it's something that we've done with drugs, We've done it with DUIs now. That's a new problem-solving court in the 18th, and with mental health treatment courts. This is a process that has brought recidivism down dramatically. Wow. That court is less than 5%. And let me tell you, Jimmy, recidivism in this state is somewhere around 40 to 50%, depending on the kind of programs you're talking about. But our programs are working. That's criminal justice reform that works for the people, that frankly helps people get out of the justice system and also saves taxpayers money. That's something that I've experienced doing, and I'm committed to expanding those.
Yeah, you know, John Kellner, I'm so glad that you brought that up, the recidivism issue, because that is a big part of the crux of criminal justice issues, is that when people get into the system, it's as though they feel like it seems like they can never get out of the system, and they keep becoming repeat offenders. And if you can prevent that, which is the whole idea of reducing the recidivism rate, then that is critical here when we're having any discussion of criminal justice reform, when the criminal justice system is often narrowly focused on in certain aspects of it. You know, people think, oh, it's the police and issues going on directly with the police, but there are so many different aspects to it. And recidivism really is, I think, one of the key bottom lines of that issue, real quick.
Yeah, absolutely true, because recidivism, it's the cycle, right? It's people coming back into the courts. Now, there's an element here of personal responsibility. People have to make choices that are, you know, consistent with the law, right? They have to be the ones who are saying, all right, I'm going to make a change. Now, we can help offer resources, right, to deal with the underlying issues that might be driving crime. And in the case of the Veterans Court, that had to do with things like substance abuse associated with PTSD, right? Things that happened because of their military service that really led to them spiraling out of control. And our other courts, like drug treatment court or our mental health court or our DUI court, it's about trying to deal with those underlying issues. Now, the justice system is certainly not omnipotent. It cannot solve everybody's problems, but it can help, right? It can definitely get people pointed towards the right path. And if they take that personal responsibility, that's when you're seeing recidivism go down. And the personal responsibility piece, in my mind, what makes it a success is having community members, so mentors from the community who say, hey, I want to help. Not just a probation officer telling you what you need to do this week to be successful. It's somebody and you know what, if you need help, call me. You know, I'll give you a suit and a tie to help you with that job interview. I know somebody that might hire you. Let's get you in there. You know, I'll help you work on that resume. I'll make sure you get to those places on time. I'll maybe give you a ride. It's things like that that help people really connect with the community and then make the decision to kind of stop making the bad decisions that they've been making in the past.
And then get things back off on the right foot. When you're out, you're able to acclimate back into the fullness of life and to get work, to get an experience of community and so forth. Absolutely. It's so important. Again, we're talking with John Kellner, Republican candidate for the 18th Judicial District, representing Arapahoe, Douglas, Elbert, and Lincoln counties, of course, to replace the retiring by term limits, George Brockler. We just got a couple minutes left with you, John Kellner, and I want to ask you two final questions. One of them is about your opponent, Amy Padden, because I've heard all sorts of different claims from her campaign. It seems like she's someone that has the kind of relevant experience based on if you hear or read anything that her campaign has been putting out. But I know that that is not the case. For example, one thing that she has not done is ever won a felony trial or violent crime trial, anything of that sort. Talk to us about the experience comparison between you and your very left-wing opponent.
Well, you know, that's a great point. I'm glad you mentioned that, because her campaign certainly does bill her as being an experienced prosecutor. She actually uses the term federal prosecutor. And let's be real. She was a civil attorney for the U.S. Attorney's Office. Now, civil attorneys do not prosecute crime. Now, and this is important. And I want you to think about this. If let's say you need heart surgery, right? You don't want a brain surgeon conducting that surgery. Both are doctors.
both do important work. You know, both are admirable professions. But look, you're not going to lay down on that operating table to have your heart surgery from a brain surgeon. And that's kind of the difference in what we do. I'm a criminal prosecutor. I have prosecuted crime in our community. I've prosecuted over a dozen murder cases alone in the state of Colorado. That's the kind of experience I bring to the table. My opponent, from what I can look on public records here, I think she's prosecuted three different cases. Two of them were misdemeanor DUIs. One of those DUIs she lost. The other one, I think, is a DWAI conviction, so a lesser count. And the third one looks like she was second chair on a felony case and lost that as well. That, from what I can tell, is the sum total of the trial experience of my opponent. The trial experience. And this matters because my opponent tries to say, well, my experience in state criminal court may not matter because I'm going to be a manager. And I'll tell you what, when people elect a district attorney, they're electing somebody who is setting the tone for criminal justice prosecution. That's deeply personal to victims in their community. But I worked for a Democrat DA, Stan Garnett, when I first started as a state prosecutor. And he taught me something important about leading from the front. He would get out there on a murder case in Boulder, Colorado, and prosecuted that case himself because he was the most accountable person. He set the tone. And the same thing can be said for Michael Daugherty, the current Boulder DA, Dan May down in El Paso, George Brockler here in our community. You are being elected as DA to be the lead prosecutor who sets that tone for the entire office of what the expectations are. That is the experience I bring to the table and that my opponent simply does not have.
It's hands-on. Look, I'm in Arapahoe County, and we know full well about the importance of experienced elected officials needing to be serving and representing our communities. But also, just keep in mind that Phil Weiser, Attorney General, also made a very similar case about administrative position, and we see how active he has been in a number of different lawsuits. But John Kellner, we're out of time, so final question for you, sir. Where can people go to learn more about you and your campaign in a very quick final word?
Yeah, just go to www.johnkellner.com. You can find us at John Kellner CO on Facebook or Twitter. You know, reach out to us. We've got great ways to get involved. Our campaign is in full swing in these last couple weeks. We'd be happy to have any help we can offer.
John Kellner, everybody. He absolutely needs our support in the 18th Judicial District. Best of luck to you, sir.
Thank you, Jimmy. Appreciate your time.
All right, that's it for the second hour of the show. We got to run to a break. When we come back, we'll talk with State House candidates Vicky Pine and Donald Rozier of Jefferson County. Don't go anywhere.